Welcome to Sports and a Slice of Life. And now, here's your host, Dave Lewis.
How's it going? Thank you for stopping by to check in. Coming up, we're talking basketball and life with Lindsay Gottlieb of the Cleveland Cavaliers, the first woman's college coach to move on to the NBA. But first, a word from our sponsor. Didn't become a coffee drinker until the last couple years, but now I'm into it. That's because of the I'm Up Coffee Company. What separates it from the bigger names you buy off the shelf is the quality. It's roasted to order and shipped the same day. You can get ground and whole beans that are single origin and expert blends. I have the Sunrise Hike Roast Colombian from volcanic loam soil at altitude, which goes perfectly with a couple pieces of dark chocolate. Order online. Use the promo code Dave Lewis to get 15% off your first order. The I'm Up Coffee Company. That's imupcoffee.com. Your favorite cup of coffee hasn't been roasted yet. And now, here's Lindsay Gottlieb.
You know, in this process of this decision, and my kind of where I was with it, I remember when Joanne Boyle took the job at Cal, and I was her assistant at Richmond, I went through a process of, what if someone like Devin A. Hampton and Ashley Walker and Alexis Gray Lawson, great players, what if they don't listen to me? I played in the Ivy League. Or, you know, I'm at Richmond, and I was scared, you know? And then I came out here, and it was the greatest thing that ever happened to me in my life, coming to Cal. Met my husband here, had our son, coached the most incredible young women. You have to do things that scare you in order to know that you can do them. And so for me, I referenced that, and I'm like, how can I not do this?
I love that life lessons representing the wine and gold of the Cleveland Cavaliers. Assistant coach Lindsay Gottlieb is on the show today. How are you?
I'm good. How are you, Dave? Good to be with you again. We've had some great memories, especially your voice narrating our Final Four run. So it's great to be back with you.
Oh, man, that 2013, such a special year with a lot of great friends, and glad to keep in touch with you all these years. Lindsay, what do you do right now with the team's season over, not going to that Orlando bubble, and you didn't get a chance to have the squad reach its full potential by, you know, playing out the year? So what's going on with the squad in terms of workouts, and what do you do at this point?
Well, it's obviously an unprecedented time for everyone, but we're in a little bit of a holding pattern now because the other eight teams, as you know, we've given ourselves a lot of different names, but we're sticking with the other eight, you know, we're trying to figure out a way along with the NBA to have us do something. So we don't know exactly what that will look like yet. So I think it'll be maybe another week or so here before we find out if we're able to do a training camp, if we're able to get any type of scrimmage games with the other seven teams in our same boat. So we're kind of on hold a bit. We're hoping to be able to do something. Our guys want to play. We have a young group. Development is important. So we'll see what they say on that. And if for some reason we're not allowed to do anything, we'll probably officially have a break and then come back in the fall when we're allowed to ahead of training camp. But we're hoping to do something somehow over the summer in some form or fashion with the teams that are not going to Orlando.
What was the way you guys stayed connected during the pandemic to keep these guys sharp?
Well, you know, for people who, all of us, the coaching staff, the players, for people who've been a part of a team pretty much every single day of our adult lives, this has been hard. Not hard like we're on the front lines of the pandemic, certainly, and not hard, you know, like being sick would be hard. But in our world, you have to find other ways to connect. So there's been a lot of texting, a lot of Zooms, a lot of virtual workouts. And then when the state of Ohio opened up, we opened the facility on a very limited basis around, I think it was May 5th or so. So only four, I believe, player development coaches or assistant coaches have been going in. I haven't been in that group. So there's been a little bit of limited contact. I have sat in the parking lot a couple times and seen the guys go in and out and pick up their meals just to socialize for an hour. But we've really had to be creative because for our young group, the development on the court is a big thing for us, but also building chemistry. And we do feel like we had some momentum with that. So we've just tried to stay connected. In particular, you know, the guy I've probably spent the most time with is Colin Sexton, because for a while there we were watching film. You know, I was breaking down his games. We would watch it together on FaceTime just to try and keep him in that rhythm that was so successful for him. Yeah, we'll try and stay connected as much as we can during this long break, because that's really important for our group.
I know you've been asked a million times about what's it like coaching guys. And Colin Sexton has been one of your biggest advocates What's that connection been like?
Well, to be honest, I mean, connecting with the guys has been probably the easiest, most seamless part of the transition. You know, I've said this a number of times that high-level athletes, male, female, college, pro, I think I found that they look for the same things in their coaches. You know, they want you to know what you're doing. You know, you have to know what you're talking about, and you have to be able to make them better. And then you also have to be able to connect to them as human beings. So Colin is unbelievable. I've never seen someone so focused. I've never seen someone so hardworking, so driven. And so we really connected basketball wise when, you know, our former coach, Coach Beilein, sort of assigned me to Colin to do a film with him. That was, just really beneficial for me to get to know him better. And I think he really opened up, because when you're doing that, you know, 15 minutes of film on a game day, sometimes you're watching film and sometimes you're just talking. And so I think we really connected mostly through those film sessions. But, you know, then I'm asking him about his home life or how he's feeling on a particular day or when something tough happened on the court or something great. So we just were able to kind of build the bond that way.
I know that you spoke about when you took the job and, you know, what two things make you successful, even as a college coach, too, is being able to be authentic, you know, true, and, you know, connect with the players and obviously know your stuff. So you're bringing both those things to the table. Who were some of the influences on you early on in your coaching career that said, you know what, hey, it's not about just, hey, learning how to crack this zone defense or substituting players?
Well, you know Joanne Boyle really well. She was probably the single most influential person on my career. She hired me when I was 24, when she got her first head coaching job at the University of Richmond. And I tell people in college coaching all the time, there's no one right path, right? I don't think you have to go with the first time head coach. Certainly, you know, if you go to work for a legend, you know, who's been at it for 30 some odd years, like Tara Vanderveer for your first job, I'm sure you also learn a lot. But for me, Joanne taking her first head coaching job and sort of saying to me, come along and do it with me, allowed me to sort of be in that seat next to her and watch how she approached everything. And not only could she, you know, coach the game of basketball, obviously, but I got to see her attention to detail with scouting reports. I got to see the way she was able to connect with people. And she also gave me the freedom to be me. I wasn't trying to be a mini Joanne. I wasn't trying to, you know, be her, another version of her. She allowed kind of me to be her partner in the process, which allowed me to find my own voice. So she was probably the single most influential in terms of my coaching career. But I've also had the opportunity to work with USA Basketball and watch the different coaches come in. And someone like Dawn Staley stuck out to me as the person who was most comfortable in her own skin in this high pressure job of USA Basketball, watching her take that on. I've had the ability to be around Gino quite a bit, and the way that he teaches the game. So I've been trying to absorb from people as much as I can throughout my career to hone in on what works for me.
Oh, since you mentioned Gino, you had a chance to speak with him a couple years ago when UConn came out. You had this chat with champions. Steve Kerr was there too. And I love this. You sat and you asked him, hey, who was your most difficult player to coach? So check out what Gino's response was.
Anybody that made National Player of the Year. We had, I don't know, 6, 7, 8 of them. They were all difficult. That's what made them great. All the great players are difficult to coach, but in a good way. Because they challenge everything you say and everything you do, and you better be right. And they think they're right about everything. So when you prove to them that you're more right than they are, it's the greatest feeling.
And I watched you nodding your head during that answer. You say, yeah, that makes sense. Does that resonate to you? Like, you know what? These women I've had before are really good, but they're also a challenge.
Yeah, it's actually been one of the most fascinating parts of coming to the NBA, and maybe why my mentality was conducive to me making this jump. I think that sometimes in college, everyone, you know, coaches want things to be easy. And I get it, right? When you don't have to worry about if someone's going to show up on time, or you don't have to worry about if someone's going to run your play exactly correctly, it's a little bit easier on a coach. But to me, I found a lot of reward in players who push the envelope a little bit, in players that if you allow them to be creative, you kind of get more out of them. And similarly in the NBA, I mean, these are great guys, but they're very, very smart basketball wise. And so they're confident enough to challenge you a little bit. And that's neat. I tell everyone about, you know, Tristan Thompson, he is just a basketball savant. you know, he knows coverages. He's going back to, oh, you know, when they ran that in the 2018 playoff game. So you have to be on your toes, and it's not defiant, but it challenges you a little bit. And I have a lot of fun with players like that. So, you know, Gino had more National Players of the Year than anybody, but, you know, for me to have sort of some outside the box people like Brittany Boyd was challenging at times, but in a good way, or Christine Anigwe, could push me a little bit, to your wit's end, but then you come back around and it makes you better. And I think a lot of NBA players who are great, probably I would say, you know, do that as well. And, you know, watching, I'm sure everyone who's listening to this podcast probably watched The Last Dance. You know, you see with that Bulls team, there were a lot of characters on there, not just Michael Jordan, but a lot of people who could maybe push the coaching staff to their limits a little bit.
I know you're so thorough and prepared. You call yourself, I remember years ago, you know, basketball nerd, but you also prepare your message to the team. And it's more than just, hey, let's get out and run and guard them and rebound, we'll win. But there's some life messages, you know, some of your quotes that you'd have even before the game, that it was really more than just about basketball, but it's about developing people. It's kind of a cliche when you say we're developing, you know, men and women, but you really took that seriously.
Oh, I mean, it was the most important thing to me. And I think it doesn't have to be sort of mutually exclusive from wanting to win. I think it goes hand to hand, for sure in college, because I would talk to our young women a lot about, you know, what they want to be when they're done with college, and how the platform of Cal basketball and what we're doing every day could be, you know, a springboard to whatever's next. And I think it's actually the same in the NBA. These are more fully formed adults, but they still want you to care about their lives off the court, or be able to connect what's going on the court to maybe how they're feeling in life. And for me as a head coach at Cal, I felt like kind of having a pulse for what the message might be going into a particular game or going into a particular, you know, big week of games was important, because otherwise it gets stale, right? You can't just talk about help side defense over and over and over. You have to mix in the why and what might resonate with them on why this particular game was important mentality wise, or things like that. So I think that's part of coaching is the psychology aspect of knowing where your group is and being able to tap into that.
And I was totally fired up reading some of the, you know, the pregame quotes that you'd have on the board. I wanted to go do the Tony Robbins firewalk on the 2000 degree coals. I was so inspired. You're ready to take my game to the next level.
Well, I always had to try to outdo myself a little bit, but you know, you mentioned the nerd thing. I mean, you know, Dave, I would go everywhere from Aristotle to, you know, yep, to a movie quote to, you know, the players got pretty hyped when I used Jay-Z or Eminem. So I'll try to show my range a little bit to keep them engaged.
When you talk about beyond the court, I think of a couple of your players, Leisure Clarendon, very socially conscious, and Rashawn DeGray, who started a nonprofit, No Gray Areas, in South Central Los Angeles to really uplift the Black community. Some lessons learned, life lessons from their time at California with you.
Well, I would turn that around and say I probably learned as much from young women like Leisure and Rashonda and some of the other that I coach as they learned from me. It's really a unique time in college. You know, someone like Leisure, you just kind of watched her step into her own, you know, greatness in terms of realizing how much power she has as a human being beyond just being, you know, an incredible player. Obviously, we witnessed her have one of the best runs probably you and I have seen of basketball in that NCAA tournament her senior year. But now to see kind of where she's gone with that, it's pretty unbelievable to see how she's turned her basketball prowess into having an impact in all parts of society. And someone like Rashonda, who, you know, came from such hard circumstances and didn't get to Cal and say, okay, I've made it and I'm going to take care of me. She got to Cal and said, oh, I've made it. I'm going to turn around and help as many people as I can have opportunities like I've had. It's just, it's unbelievable. And certainly they and the other young women that I was able to be around, I think made me a better person all the way around.
Yeah. Rashonda's story blew me away because she was one of several kids in a one bedroom apartment, South Central, and her room was like in the back of the apartment to stay away from the gunfire. So she certainly has seen, you know, the highs and the lows of life and really could appreciate the little things.
Yeah. I mean, I remember hearing her tell that story, and how are you not moved to tears when her mother would be pushing the kids to the back of her room to make sure they wouldn't you know, get caught with gunfire. I mean, it's just, it's unfathomable to think about it, but that's the reality for many, you know, human beings in our country, unfortunately. But for her to, she would say almost be saved by a program called After School All-Stars. And then, you know, she had a really incredible couple take her in and mentor and help her in Marissa and Tyrone. And just, it's an unbelievable story. And yet, in every day I was around her, she'd be the first person to give you the shirt off her back, even if that's all she had. And she thrived at Cal. You know, there are a lot of people who said, oh, why would you go to Cal? You can't make it there academically. And she graduated with over a 3.0. Like you said, she started her own foundation. You know, she's had a successful professional career since then. It's just, it's unbelievable. You know, what she's done with her talents and abilities. And I think she's probably just at the beginning of what she will do.
There's so much going on in the world, of course, with the killing of George Floyd. What has been eye-opening to you with this experience and your communication with your current players?
My gosh. You know, this obviously, I'm not sort of new to political awareness. You know, my father was a politician and an activist. We grew up in a household, I think, that valued social justice movements. And yet at each point in your life, you can still grow. I've told people, you know, people think that I care about these issues, you know, because I have a Black husband or a biracial son. And I tell people, actually, the time that impacted me most closely was coaching a mostly Black team at Cal and seeing the world through their eyes and the experiences that they went through. You know, we flew commercial and we'd be going through the, you know, security, and inevitably someone would get stopped and, you know, searched, and it wasn't me ever. And watching, you know, the way some commentators and fans talked about these women who you and I knew so intimately. And it was hurtful sometimes just to hear some of the language that was used, right? And just to hear their experiences, or to be with the team, you know, the night after the election, and, you know, sometimes people get elected that you want and sometimes that you don't want. But I had a player call me and say, why does the country hate us? I'm afraid. Right. So you hear stories in that way. And unfortunately, you know, the things that were being protested at Cal, you know, when I was there 3, 4, 5 years ago, you know, you see again in this particular moment, you know, with the killing of George Floyd. I think what the difference is now is, I don't know whether it's just it's time or the pandemic, but I think you've seen a different type of change in terms of how people are approaching this. And here's the thing, that's when I say you can always learn something new. You know, we were on a Zoom call with our Cavs players talking about this. And, you know, we had a player on the team who, you know, makes a lot more money than you or me, and just said with a lot of vulnerability, every single time a police officer comes near my car, I am afraid. And it's just, there's no amount of success, there's no amount of money, you know, that changes for people who have Black skin in terms of how they feel in this country. And I think this is probably the moment where more people are able to just step outside themselves and try and see, you know, that there are systemic problems that impact people. And even if it doesn't impact us every single day, it's time that we, you know, stand with them. It's time that we feel it as if it was us. And my hope is that this moment in history produces real change. I think the Cavs organization has been incredible around this, not just, you know, JB, our head coach, and Kobe, our GM, but the entire organization has been really proactive. And it's been just kind of powerful for me to see such great leadership. And I'm just proud to be part of the movement of these guys and looking forward to what we're able to do next to continue not only these conversations, but some action to make our community stronger.
Credit to the Cavs for being at the forefront of the movement. JB Bickerstaff accepting his nomination to the National Coaches Association Committee on Racial Injustice and Reform, working with our good friend Lloyd Pierce of the Hawks. Hey, I want to take you back to your early coaching. You come out of Brown as a senior and you send 351 individual letters to every Division I program in the country. And not just a form letter, they were individually done with background on each of the teams and the coaches. How long did that take to do?
So this is going to, you know, date me a little bit and show my age, but so I was a senior at Brown. I graduated in 99, so it must have been sort of winter break of 98, you know, about to be 99. And as athletes, you're on campus for a long time during winter break. And at Brown, it's a particularly long winter break. I think it's 6 weeks where it's just the athletes. And at that point, I knew I wanted exactly what I wanted to do. I wanted to be a college basketball coach. And my peers at Brown at the time, you know, they were doing career fairs for, you know, consulting jobs, or they were applying to law school, or they were, you know, kind of lining up their job. And I felt like I wanted to be doing something. And so I knew I was close with my assistant coaches. And they said, well, you have to go to the Final Four in the spring. That's where, you know, networking happens. And so I bought my ticket. I prepared to do that. But for me, it wasn't enough. I didn't want to wait until April to be doing something. So during winter break, that was my project, was to reach out to every single coach in Division I. So, I typed the letters. I sent them out. I remember finding the names and addresses. There was like a book. There was a book that everyone had, like a hardcover book. Every college, you know, coaching staff had it, that you literally just go through and you find the mailing address of the athletic department and the head coach's name. And I personalized each one. And there were a lot of people that I had some kind of connection to. So my best friend from high school played at Duke. That's how I knew Joanne, but it's also how I knew Gino, because everyone recruited her. So in those letters I wrote, you know, Debbie Ryan from Virginia, hey, you may remember me because you came and did a home visit with my friend and you came to our school that day. You know, I tried to just have some reason that someone might read to the bottom of the letter. Or if it was someone that, you know, I had looked at their campus or what have you. So I tried to personalize each one and I sent out these letters. And then I will say it was pretty fun going to my little, you know, P.O. box at Brown, the next several weeks, seeing who was going to write me back and, you know, going into my little box and getting letters from all these schools that didn't recruit me, like Tennessee and, you know, Pat Summit, and Tara Vanderveer wrote me a handwritten note. And so it made for an exciting spring semester. And ultimately, I booked a bunch of interviews and some out at the Final Four and some in the spring. And turned out that Syracuse was the job offer for me that felt like the best fit. And the day after graduation, I had my first job in college coaching.
You mentioned all the letters. I thought 99, because I know it's the early years of the internet, that maybe you could have even emailed all those. That would have taken forever. But you actually did real letters for 351 schools.
I did. They were wow. Stamps, letters, the whole deal. I think I was on a computer and not a typewriter. But I remember doing them in the office, like in the women's basketball office. Practice would be for whatever, 2 hours during winter break, and my friends would probably go off to the movies or whatever. And I was working on my winter break project, which was to try and get a job in coaching.
I want to go back to that soundbite when I first introduced you, and you mentioned about having to do things that scare us, and that holds so many people back. The fear of even trying in the first place, the fear of even taking a shot at failing. Where did you get that?
Definitely my parents, and in separate ways. So my father did a number of different cool things in his career. He was a New York State legislator before I was born. And then he drove down to the Martin Luther King, I Have a Dream speech, drove some protesters from New York and went to that march. And then he had a private practice law firm, and then he became a judge. And I remember talking to him about career stuff. And I said, well, how did you know? Like, how did you know? How did you set yourself up for the next thing? Or how did you know what was the right thing? And he kind of laughed at me because I was more type A than he was. You know, my dad was a really laid back guy. And he just said, you know, I didn't plan everything out. I knew what felt right at the time. And when it felt like the right thing, then I did it. And it was a kind of a simple message, but you know, the trusting your gut, the going with what your instinct is, the always trying to do what's right and not to try to get yourself ahead. I really learned that from him. And then my mom was really influential in the sense that she was a stay-at-home mom. I'm the youngest of four kids. So my oldest sister's 10 years older than me. So my mom was a stay-at-home mom, you know, raising all of us until I was about, you know, I can't remember the exact age, maybe 12. And she, you know, she kind of had enough of that. And I was old enough. So she went back to work, and she went back to work as an office manager in a stock brokerage. And then she kind of said, okay, well, enough of this. If I'm going to work here, I might as well be a stockbroker. And so she worked her way up, took the exam, and ended up, you know, being a stockbroker before she passed away. So in retrospect, when I've thought about decisions in my life and I think about how my mindset works, there's no question. I saw my parents live life a certain way that, that just, I think, led me in the right direction.
You lost your mom while you were in college. And I know when you took the Cavaliers job, you mentioned her as one of the first things you thought about. No doubt would be very proud.
Sure. I mean, you know, it's so long ago that she passed away. But I mean, anyone, I think, who's lost a parent or a mom, you know, a daughter who's lost a mother, you know, that just their influence on your life is there all the time. And it's happy memories. It's happy thoughts, right? Like I hadn't decided I wanted to go into coaching by the time she passed away when I was 19. In fact, that was part of the impetus. You know, I went away my junior year of college abroad, you know, partly because I was just handling her death and needed to do something different. And that's when I decided I wanted to go into coaching. So her influence has really been there the whole time. But, you know, just the thought of the NBA, my mom loved Michael Jordan. She loved basketball. And I literally think about, you know, oh, she would love Kevin Porter Jr. Or she would be talking about, you know, Kevin Love's jump shot, or, hey, you know, the people that I get to interact with. I know she would think it was super cool. So one really, really neat thing this year was that for International Women's Day, the Cavs organization, you know, sold a jersey with my name on it in the team shop, which was pretty cool. Just to me, to represent all women. It wasn't really about me, but they asked what number I wanted on the jersey. And so I chose number 3 because that was my mom's favorite number. And so it's just neat. It's neat to kind of feel like she's a part of this whole thing, even though, you know, more of my life I've been alive without her in it than when she was here, but her influence is still pretty great.
What's it like for you being a working mom in the NBA?
Ooh, it's a lot of planning. It's a lot of logistics. It's a lot of amazing caregivers. I don't think people who choose childcare as a profession get enough credit. So it's interesting. When Patrick and I decided to have a child, it was at the point in my career where I was a head coach, which you know, allowed me to create my own schedule a little bit. I mean, the season is what it is, and there's responsibilities in recruiting and games and being around that doesn't change. But in terms of how I was going to balance everything was sort of up to me. And I remember telling the team that, hey, when I told them, you know, when the baby was coming, I said, I'm still going to be the same accessible coach. I'm still going to be the coach whose door is open. You can come and talk to me, but there may be a baby here. And sure enough, you know, that whole first year, Jordan and our nanny were around the office quite a bit, and the kids would come in, and sometimes I would be nursing during a meeting, and that's just how it was. Well, making the shift to the NBA, it was also a conscious decision. I asked a lot of questions about what that might look like. And, you know, I for me, in terms of travel, there's more travel in the NBA and there are more games. So like if it's a 1 or 2 day trip, I will go without Jordan. If it's longer than that, I often had, you know, either Patrick or one of our caregivers bring Jordan on the road, so he gets some cool experiences. The biggest difference in the NBA, though, is that when I'm not actually watching film or at a game or traveling, I can be without my phone and be more present with the family. So, you know, it's a little bit of a trade-off. There's more travel, but there's less recruiting and time away. And I think the main thing is, you know, I didn't sort of take this job to kind of prove anything to anyone, but I just, you know, like you said at the beginning, want to be authentic. And so the mom part of me is part of who I am. And, you know, our players love Jordan. They see him around a lot. I think they see me being a mom, but they also see me being a dedicated coach. And ultimately, you hope that you impact people positively just by seeing that you can look a different way and have a different life and still do your job at the highest level.
I remember seeing Jordan with some Twitter pictures when you were recruiting at Cal. He had to be the ultimate closer, right? I mean, you're going to get the kid when you bring a beautiful Jordan around.
It was just fun to see his relationship with everyone, right? With players, with recruits, you know, with people around the department. But it really hasn't changed with the Cavs. I'll tell you one funny story about that. So Jordan's 3 and he's going to be starting like pre-primary school this fall. Hopefully, you know, if everything's open and in person. But there was a day that we were going to visit the school. And so you know, the school had recommended you tell your kid, hey, you're going to meet some new friends. You're going to your school and going to play with some friends. So wake up that morning and say, hey, Jordan, we're going to go to school today. And, you know, you're going to see some friends. And he said, oh, Colin and Darius are going to be there. So I have the only 3-year-old who thinks that the starting backcourt, you know, for the Cleveland Cavaliers are his friends that are going to be at school with him. So he makes friends everywhere he goes. And we do miss the relationships with the college, you know, women that we were around. And at the same time, he's up in the family room playing with JB's kids and, you know, the other coaching staff members, children and around the team quite a bit. So he definitely gets a lot of cool experiences. That's for sure.
I want to get away from the whole, you know, woman in the NBA thing, because you're just a damn good coach and regardless of sex, you're excellent at it. But what has been the hardest thing to learn that's different from the pro game to the college game for you?
It's really the rhythm and the kind of schedule of it, to be honest. So in college, you play roughly 35 games a year, right? I think it's 29 regular season games, and then you're hoping for as much postseason as possible. And from the course, from when you start practice in October through when you're done in March and April, it's like 35 or so games and 100 and some odd practices. And I knew that routine and rhythm like the back of my hand. I did it for 20 years, you know, 3 prep days before a game or 2 prep days before a game, then 1 in between day, then you play again. When do you give them rest? When do you ramp it up a little bit? When do you get on them? When do you back off? Well, coming to the NBA, the basketball isn't terribly different. The relationships with people are a little bit different, but not at its core. But the biggest difference is there are 82 games. And once you start that season, there's just not a ton of practice time. So, you know, you may not be talking about the opponent until that morning at shoot around. So I did a bunch of scouts. You know, JB would have us present the scout on the day and we'd be presenting it the day of the game, not 2 or 3 days before. So that was different. More of the focus, you have to focus on yourself, because they're just, the opponents just keep on coming and keep on coming. And so you have to, you know what you're doing. I think there's more of an emphasis on ATOs, like after timeouts, and being able to execute, because there's so many situations that become important down the stretch. And then the other main thing is that you just talk so much more basketball in the NBA. I've talked more basketball in the last year than I had in the last 5 years combined, because in college, you're just pulled in so many directions with recruiting and housing and academics and, you know, trying to help the players get jobs and internships. And here, you know, you're working on relationships and you're talking ball. And so I do think I've improved quite a bit just with, you know, basketball and film and analytics, because there's so much at your disposal to be able to do with that in the NBA.
Since you just mentioned so much basketball, what do you like to do or what do you like to watch to detach yourself when you can to get away from basketball?
Well, there's not that much time to get away from basketball. I do enjoy it. On my own, I am interested in documentaries. I am interested in books that push me to think about things in a different way. You know, not just in this time, but things like, you know, social justice or ways we can improve the world that we live in. I'm drawn to kind of powerful things like that. I also do like just sort of politics and current events. So I'm currently reading a book. This is kind of interesting. So there's a senator in the state of Ohio, Senator Brown, Sherrod Brown, and his wife is a Pulitzer Prize winning columnist for the Cleveland Plain Dealer. I don't know them personally at all, but I started following her on social media, found her interesting. Well, she wrote a book during her husband's campaign for Senate in 2006. And it's been fascinating for me because it's a little bit flipped. It's the woman who gave up sort of her career at the time to campaign for her husband. And so there's, you know, there's gender dynamics, there's politics. She's a great writer. So that's been an interesting book, you know, that I'm reading. But the other thing that I'm much more into now than I ever have before is Disney movies, because we don't let Jordan do a ton of screen time, but when he does, it's usually Disney. So I've, this quarantine, man, I've watched a lot of Disney stuff, Moana, Frozen, Tarzan, Toy Story, you name it.
Does he watch them over and over the same
ones?
Yeah,
he only watches like little segments. So it might take us, you know, 2 weeks to get through you know, Moana. And then he wants to watch, and then he wants to go back and watch that same song again. So I'm like, but I want to see what happens, you know? So he gets, you know, kind of little chunks of time to watch. And so, yes, I know the songs from Moana and Tarzan and Frozen.
Anyone I've talked to that's been in the league, you know, during this pandemic, the one thing they get out of it that they feel is rewarding is the quality family time and to connect in a way that you wouldn't be able to do in, you know, February, March, April.
Sure. But I was talking to Kobe, our GM, on the phone the other day, and I said, you know, part of the appeal of coming to the NBA was a little bit more of an off season, right? Like, you just don't get an off season in college. I said, but I didn't ask for 9 months. We don't, this is extreme. No, but the time with the family has been great. Obviously great, you know, grateful for that, even despite the hard times that, you know, the country is going through, obviously. And I hope that this realm of NBA basketball kind of allows me to have some more of that in the off season. I'm not, you know, I'm not foolish. Like, I travel a lot, and I'm not a traditional kind of mother in that sense during the season, but I do think the NBA will allow me to, I don't know, the schedules is different, right? So you're coming back off of back-to-back, and maybe we don't have to be at the arena until five that day. Like, I could probably, you know, take him to school and do some things even during the season that I wouldn't otherwise get to do. And then certainly, you know, need to really take advantage of the time in the off season that, that I do get to spend, you know, more present with the family.
Have you gotten any sense of when the next season would start? I've heard different things, you know, close to Christmas because of, you know, this season possibly going into October.
Right. I mean, we've heard early December. I don't think that is set in stone yet. But I heard, you know, closer to like December 1 than Christmas. But I think that still needs to be, you know, decided on by the players and, you know, and the ownership together. That would be obviously a very quick turnaround for the teams that are in the finals. But for those of us, you know, that are done or people that end early in Orlando, with all this extra time off, I think people will be itching to play. I think what will be interesting from there is what happens in the future, because from what I've heard, you know, there's been some talk about moving the NBA schedule, sort of past the NFL season anyway, because that's when ratings spike and all that. So it'd be interesting to see if we do that this year because of everything getting shifted because of the coronavirus. I wonder if we'll stick with a, you know, December to July schedule, or if we'll go back to the more October to June. So we'll see.
I was just thinking about the time I worked with you in Berkeley, and I coached middle school basketball at the time. So every drill, including the pregame shooting where you had to compete, you had one team on one side, another team at the other, and you'd shoot different shots. And I forget the number we would count to, but there was a winning team. Even the baseline out of bounds play, one called Irish. I stole all that stuff and won a Tri-Valley championship, and it was all based on the California Golden Bears. So I can't thank you enough.
Oh, that's awesome. It's funny, like, you know, some of that stuff, Irish, you know, we did I can't remember when it was, during training camp or whatever. And I was coaching, you know, one of our teams, and it was a situational thing. And I think, you know, I ran Irish, and you'd think it'd be really different throwing to, you know, Tristan Thompson on a lob, but we had some post players back in the day who could get up and get it, you know, from Devin A. Hampton to Rashonda to Christina Nigue. So, definitely, some quick hitters for lobs that in the NBA become dunks. I got a couple of those in my back pocket when they're needed.
It was a little tougher with 13-year-olds, but they got the gist of it. Hey, I'm super proud of you. And, I know, you know, you getting tweeted from Billie Jean King and getting a text from Adam Silver just shows you've made it, young lady. You've come a long way. Congratulations.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
That's a 5-star conversation with Lindsay Gottlieb of the Cleveland Cavaliers. You can subscribe to the Dave Lewis Show on iHeartRadio, iTunes, Google Play, YouTube, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our executive producer is Hunter Lewis. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll talk to you next time.